From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The old models of governing and doing business are falling by the wayside. Former Governor Mike Leavitt says if you're too wieldy, if you're not nimble enough, eventually you're going to collapse. The next phase in the evolution of human productivity, he says, is collaboration. Creating networks of people with differing interests to come together to get something done. And by getting something done, Leavitt means different things. Think healthcare, think the environment, think politics. Leavitt isn't squishy about the word collaboration. He isn't thinking about it as an attitude or a mindset. He says it's a skill set. Today in the program, we're live at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Mike Leavitt is among our guests to talk about how you build alliances. And here's a spoiler. The secret sauce is trust. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Collaboration is one of those broad buzzwords you hear about from time to time, like synergy and community. But when former Governor Mike Leavitt uses the word these days, he's not thinking about it in abstract terms. In a new book he's co-written, Leavitt says collaboration is not just an attitude. It's not some soft concept. It's a very particular skill set, one that has key elements, eight of them to be exact. The broad idea behind the particulars is this need to build allies and alliances today in a complex social, economic, and political landscape. Healthcare, of course, comes to mind as one of those areas that needs some collaborative structure to work through its challenges, but so does the environment, so does technology and science, and of course, so does politics. Today in the program, we're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah, and we're talking about the elements that bring and keep people together. We invite you to join us. We don't have the ability, actually, to take calls, but you can send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. Mike Leavitt was Utah's governor from 1993 to 2003 under President George W. Bush. He also served as Secretary of Health and Human Services and as an administrator, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. These days, Governor Leavitt is chairman of Leavitt Partners. It's a healthcare consulting firm. And Governor Mike Leavitt, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. I'm delighted to be with you and the listeners here in the Hinckley Institute.
I should mention, since you did refer to the listeners here in the Hinckley Institute, we also have a microphone for you to be able to ask questions a little bit later in the program, too. Rich McKeon is also with us. He served as Governor Leavitt's chief of staff at Health and Human Services and the EPA and in the governor's office. He's president and CEO of Leavitt Partners, which he and the governor co-founded and, of course, co-writer of this book, Finding Allies, Building Alliances, Eight Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. And Rich McKeon, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate the chance to be here, Doug.
Well, I guess let me start with the beginnings of all of this. Governor, you've talked about the fact that when you were working through problems throughout your career in public policy, that you were often jotting little things down along the way, that you sort of insights, epiphanies, I suppose, that's what led you to create a book like this?
I began to observe that almost every successful solution we arrived at in complex environments involved a collaboration. I also began to observe that the world was beginning to intuitively organize itself into networks. And I'm not talking just about computer networks. I'm talking about governments and businesses and supply chains and literally every aspect of society organizing itself into networks, and that essentially In a network, the sociology of a network is collaboration. It's getting pieces of a puzzle to work together smoothly and efficiently. And I observed that some succeeded and others didn't. Rich and I were at the federal government together, and we had begun to write down our theory on why they worked and why they didn't.
Yeah.
And we actually had an opportunity with some people at EPA to deploy them on a project. And so we asked them to take the elements that we had uncovered and to compare virtually every collaborative enterprise that the EPA and later the Department of Health and Human Services were involved in, and ask them why did they succeed and why did they fail. And these eight elements really are what we learned from that experience.
I wonder, you write about this, the premise, the need for alliances. Old models, they're wieldy, they've become inefficient, pretty dysfunctional. So why did they work in the past? Just because we were in a less complicated landscape?
I think we were in a less competitive environment. We now have a global market that requires us to get better every day in order to maintain any kind of leadership, whether it's market, economic, or political. And I think it's safe to say that a network, an efficient network, will always be more effective than a group of siloed, if you will, mainframes, to use a computer analogy, trying to work together. And therefore, we're seeing more and more of them. In fact, when you begin to catch on to this concept, you see them everywhere. This is one of those concepts that when you begin to understand it, it becomes enlivened in your mind, and you start seeing how they come together.
You know, I might just add that there's not many in this audience, but there are a few who will remember that when ATMs first merged in the marketplace, that you would go to the airport or someplace and there would be literally a dozen different ATMs, each for a different bank. And over the course of time, those businesses recognized the inefficiency of servicing them, of manning them, of having different technologies that they had to support. And they began to create a platform, a uniform platform, that all of them competitors used to their advantage, and each in their own way began to expand their capacity, and it enriched everybody. And this happens in many different sectors in the business world, and we'd suggest in the government world as well.
It was through collaboration that we went from many ATMs to one. It was the way that we began to see cell phones. I mean, literally, there was a day when you had to have people inside your network to call them on a cell phone. Now, through collaboration and through effectively developing these networks, not just technologically, but the human networks, we've learned over time that it's easy to get computers to work together by comparison to getting people to work together. And this is really about the sociology of making networks function, not just how you get the digits to travel down a piece of fiber.
That's what I want to get to. I want to spend some time with this human component of all of this, because it seems like if you're talking about the fact that in collaboration, if collaborations are in today's environment organic, if they just happen, then what's the need for a book that has, you know, these outlines and things like that? Is it the human component? Is this the sociological component that you can't really account for?
Oh, I think the point is they don't just happen.
Yeah.
There is
structure to
them.
There
is,
if they work.
And the point of the book is you can get better at this.
Yeah.
You can be more efficient, more effective. You can do what it used to take you 4 years to do, you could do it in two. What used to take 3 months can be done in one. When it failed before, you can make it work. And I think our book argues that the new frontier of human productivity is the ability to solve problems in a networked, collaborative style, and that it's a skill set that we need to nurture and develop and respect and acknowledge.
Is this what you mean by collaborative intelligence?
That's exactly what we mean when we use the phrase collaborative intelligence. We coined that term. The term emotional intelligence has been used for a while, but collaborative intelligence, at least we think we're among the first to use that. But it's the ability. It goes beyond just having a cooperative attitude. It's understanding how to structure human interaction in a way that it's most likely to produce a positive outcome.
And I think part of that, too, is whether or not collaborative intelligence is innate or whether it is something that can be learned. And if it can be learned, it can certainly be improved. And that is part of what I think we look at here. I think, in part, we wrote this as an investment guide, if you will, for CEOs who may be contemplating whether or not to use resources in a collaborative.
Or PTA presidents who are trying to figure out whether to solve a problem in their neighborhood, or college presidents you go on and on and on.
And their capacity to look at these elements, if the elements aren't there, frankly, they'll fail. These are not worth investing in. That's the bottom line.
Let's talk about that sociology of collaboration. because you spend some time with this in the book, that this, because this, as you say, is the tricky part, more art than science. So you say no matter how effective the system may be, it's not going to work if you can't get people to get along. So you have to manage the human element. So what is it? The idea, I guess, you've got egos involved, you've got agendas, you've got biases, you've got differing styles. What do you have to understand about human nature to approach this process? What did you learn about human nature as you were working through that part?
Well, I think one of the most important things we observed was the first element, which is common pain. People do not intuitively say, I'm just going to work together with others and give up things that I now control in order to get something done on a larger scale. People will not do that unless they feel some sense of pain or opportunity that causes them to do something. It's a bit counterintuitive. And I would suggest that is among the most important things to measure. When you are working with other people, do they have an incentive? Are their interests or aligned with yours? They don't have to be exactly the same, but they just have to have something that will cause them to come together.
And maybe it would be worthwhile to just reflect a little bit on the people that you bring together here, because this collaborative intelligence, I suspect that those who are in the audience recognize that there are just people who are naturally advocates, who have an adversarial nature about them, and they have a position that they're going to stake out and they're going to argue, whereas there are some who literally are problem solvers and who have a capacity to both listen and to have an abundance mentality and to be transparent or more transparent in the way that they operate. And it's those people who are kind of principle focused and have the capacity to really be in a problem-solving mode as opposed to staking out a position and defending it, that are the people who succeed in these endeavors.
Learning to read people and understand their interests, and not just their curiosities, but their economic interests, what motivates them. We learn a lot from the things we fail at, and we write about some of the failures in the book. One of the more interesting was post-Katrina. Yeah. I was Secretary of Health. I was in New Orleans. The healthcare system had literally been blown away. You had hundreds of thousands of people who were returning to the city, and they needed a healthcare system. And so I convened the various components of the community to say, we're prepared to help you rebuild this system and to help in the meantime, but we'd like to let's see if we can't build it back better than what it was before the storm. And we brought 50-some-odd parties together into a quite elaborate and quite complicated. And it was working just fine, but I misread something, and that is I misread one of the major players who came to the table, but mostly to make certain that their interests in some way weren't disturbed in the status quo. And as time went on, it became evident that this was not going to work because they didn't feel the sense of pain economically that everyone else was there to solve, and it failed.
Skin in the game, is that another way of saying it?
Skin in the game is another good way to put it. There's lots of different kinds of skin. Sometimes it's economic. Sometimes it's a policy position. Other times it can just be an ego. But reading that and bringing people together who are prepared to actually come to a conclusion is a very important part of how you bring and keep people together.
And in this case, I think the distinction was between most of the parties coming to the table to try and solve a problem and literally to improve a system, but one party came to protect its interests, and that was not revealed until quite late in the game.
So what you have to, maybe this is a crass word, strip out those who don't have standing from these groups.
Well, another one of the elements is you have to have representatives. You have to have representatives of substance.
Yeah.
You've got to have the people at the table who can actually make this happen. And if they're not at the table, then you're wasting your time. And if those who come to the table don't have the sense of common pain, this is the measurement we're talking about. Not all of these work, and they're expensive, and they take time, and they often fail. But once you are able to succeed, you create a beachhead of progress that can be built upon. But as Rich said earlier, using these eight elements as a kind of investment guide to decide whether this is really worth spending time and effort on is a valuable contribution, we believe. Often when we're in a group, we'll ask people, how many of you are actually involved right now with a collaborative project among different organizations? And everyone will raise their hand. How many of you? Two. Most will go up. How many? Three. This is just part of the way the world is working now, and so we're advancing these ideas, these principles, as a means of being able to measure the likelihood that they will succeed.
I'm going to bring this back from time to time to this question of politics. It seems like one of the most relevant things on people's minds today in terms of a problem to solve, although that's a very broad term, and I think the idea of it being particular is important, but you've talked about, Governor, the idea of a common pain, how legislative bodies, very little would get done without some sense of emergency, without some sense of common pain. This is in some way the thing that drives the legislative process?
Well, the legislative process is organized around it. I mean, look at what's just gone on with the government shutdown. We were not able to reach a sense of agreement just on the basis that the budget needed to be balanced. They had to continue to confront one another until the common pain became big enough that they ultimately found a way to both save face and to find a solution. Now, I will just suggest the point that our problems are so structural in the country right now that the democratic process that we're using is not succeeding, in my judgment, and that a more collaborative problem-solving approach will ultimately be required.
Why? Because we're too broad? We think too broadly about
it? Because we're too divided.
Too divided. Okay. That's the essential.
And if you look at the rules of the Congress, whom we depend on to solve these problems, it is not structured in a fashion to produce a solution. It's structured to produce conflict. In Congress, they call operating in the normal rules regular order. And there are times when Congress has to acknowledge that they have a problem so significant, yet so pressing, that they're not able to confront it. And they organize what they'll a special process. We've seen it with the base closure commission. They couldn't confront that, so they had to organize a collaborative process that allowed them ultimately to solve that problem by restricting the ways in which they behaved. And then we've seen it with another part of that was the Simpson-Bowles process. People nominated others. They've just not been able to yet wrestle with that. My point is that these principles do apply in democratic institutions because at some points in time, legislative processes are not adequate, that the political will simply does not exist, or the pain has not become great enough, or the problem has become too damaging, that you have to begin to employ special processes within democracies that are more collaborative.
And can I just add that this shutdown, or at least the collision that created the shutdown, was not unanticipated. I mean, clearly you could have seen the events that were going to bring about this collision. And I think if people had, from a collaborative standpoint, anticipated that, begin to organize around it and use it as an opportunity for progress, you'd see a different result. And that is something I think you've been particularly adept at, is to be able to see, Mike, where these collision points are and the ability to organize around them solutions as opposed to just letting them happen and reacting to them.
Well, but what happens if you have a process, and this was an argument made by people in the Democratic Party. Mitch McConnell, most prominently the leader of the Senate, minority leader, Republican, had talked about when President Obama was elected that one of their key principles, at least I'm not sure he expressed it this way, but it's been expressed this way by political opponents, was to undermine progress of the president. So I guess the question is there enough collective interest here? There's a lot of division, you say, but is there enough in common to be able to build a structure like this, or do you have to repair that before you can even get to it?
I don't think it's a function of changing the structure of the United States government on a permanent basis. I think we just have to acknowledge that apparently the pain in our country is not sufficient to bring people to the point of actually wanting to solve a problem as opposed to defending their partisan flag. I will tell you that in the many years I've spent in Washington, I have learned an important truth, and that is there are two things that drive Washington. One is control of the news cycle, and the second is the next election. And we are still, that's what's happening in Washington. Now, there'll be a point in time, and I don't know when it is, but there'll be a point when, to use the title of another book, a black swan event occurs, when we have economic turmoil of sufficient nature. I mean, you look back in 2008 when we had the liquidation, the bank liquidation problem. They moved heaven and earth within not weeks, not days, hours to solve problems because the institutional intransigence was set apart and they got down to the business of solving problems. Well, I think that in time we're going to find there will be moments like that and that there will be, and when those occur, it will be valuable to create and structure a collaborative process that can solve the problem, not just defend the partisan flags.
I mean, how much further do you have to go to hit bottom, though? I mean, more 2 weeks of a government shutdown, near, getting this close to, a debt crisis.
Well, look at the difference. I mean, I think this is instructive. You look at 2008 and the government shutdown, which we have already been through a couple of times, as late as 1995 and 96, and the sun comes up and people, 83% of most government workers were still working. This was a kind of manufactured crisis on both sides. But the liquidation or the banking crisis in 2008, that was very, very real.
And so we have to distinguish between what's kind of political hyperbole and what's actually pain.
Yes, and there'll be a moment in time when the pain is very real again, and it could be the downgrading of U.S. debt. It could be some kind of cascading. But the point is, when you get to the point that you need to solve problems, knowing how to structure them to produce the best and most likely a positive outcome has value, and that's what these eight elements is about. But it's not on things just as big as the U.S. government. It's about solving problems within a department or among and between different departments in a government or even environmental problems within neighborhoods, et cetera.
We're going to get to those particulars as we go along. Governor Mike Leavitt is with us. Rich McKeon, co-authors of the book Finding Allies, Building Alliances. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We invite you to email us if you have questions or comments. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. And when we get back from a break, we'll invite those of you with us here at the Hinckley Institute to join us as well if you have comments or questions. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting live from the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Former Governor Mike Leavitt is with us. Rich McKeon also with us. They've co-written a book exploring how you make collaboration work. These are techniques that could work in the world of business and policy, but they can also be applied to the current state of American politics, which is, of course, in desperate need of a little teamwork. There are those broader issues. There are particular things. We're talking about some of the factors that are involved in this collaboration, and we invite you to join us, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's talk about the foundation for all of this, really, something you call a value alliance, which is, as you say in the book, it's not a day-to-day casual sense of cooperation. This is something more formal than that. Talk about this idea of a value alliance.
Well, we have discovered over time that actually giving something a formal structure is a critical part of learning to create more effective collaboration. And part of that, for example, is actually writing down what is the objective here, concluding how we're going to reach decisions among ourselves.
But what does that say? Does that mean these are our values or this is our objective, or do they all have to play into that?
They all play into it.
Yeah.
Because what you find is that if you can't come to a decision on some of those basic things, you'll never come to a decision. Plus, it gives a sense of formality. I learned something that Rich and I laugh about this, I guess, in some respects. But we recognize that almost every collaboration is a voluntary proposition, and that's what gives it power, is that people come together voluntarily to solve a problem. But if you don't formalize it, and we would have often held what we called flags and bagpipes, where we would get all of the people together who had concluded that they would solve this problem together, put them at a table, signed a document, and had flags and bagpipes there to say this is important. We were doing one of these on the Great Lakes. I write about this in the book. And the assignment I had from the president was, I want you to figure out a way to begin to drive forward in cleaning up the water in the Great Lakes. Now, this is six states. It's tens of thousands of businesses. It's maybe 1,000 different municipalities. It's hundreds of different environmental groups. It's a very complicated proposition. And so we began to determine who will be the conveners here. We concluded, let's get the six governors and a bunch of mayors from these major cities. And they can bring it together and give it a sense of importance. And we went through all of the steps to lay this out. On the day we were going to sign the document, the convening document, which really came about through literally hundreds of different conversations, many of which I had personally.
The content of which were what? All right, don't agree about this, fine. We don't agree about this, but let me sort it all together, and this is where we are in agreement.
These are the things on which we can start with a basis on.
Gotcha.
Here are the things. Here's the way we're going to proceed. Here's how we'll make decisions. Here's who's going to pay for this, this process.
Yeah.
Here are the people who can sit at the table. Here are the rules if you are going to sit at the table in terms of your behavior. But we get to the point of launching this, and we literally had six governors lined up, ready to march into a place and sit at a table. The mayors of many large metropolitan cities in the Midwest, and we had bagpipes that began to play, and the flags of each of the states. It looked like a diplomatic event, and I won't say who it was, but it was the mayor, a very prominent mayor known all across the country, was standing next to me, and he turned and said, "This is important, isn't it?" And I said, "It is important. We're going to march in and voluntarily conclude to solve a problem." But having enough formality that people knew they were committing to it and putting their name on a piece of paper saying we're going to behave in this way, knowing they could have left any time they chose to if it looked like it wasn't going to produce a good outcome, that's a skill that we learned in being able to make these more effective.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things you write about, you spend some time talking a little bit about sort of the history of the country, this idea. In some way, I suppose the United States, or at least the convening of the Constitutional Convention, that was a value alliance.
I believe it's a great example of the way collaboration and a value alliances work, and the rich can jump in on this, but. That you'll remember the history here. The United States had just been formed following the Revolution. It was 1787. It wasn't working. We were operating under a document known as the Articles of Confederation. They needed to have something move this to a different level, and yet nobody wanted to get together. So Alexander Hamilton and James Madison wrote a paper saying we've got to collaboratively solve this. And they went to George Washington and said, "General, if you will come and convene this, everyone will show up."
Wasn't a government official at the time?
He was not an official at all. He didn't hold office. He was no longer in the military. But he was so well respected that they knew if he said, "I'm going," that signaled this is important. And he actually sat in the back of the room near the podium in the same chair every day and said virtually nothing. But because he was there, people came and were well behaved. And that's a great example of a terrific convener. And there are lots of people who have convening power. It can be government officials, it can be CEOs, but it can also be well-respected people who can draw people together. And so we write about the skills of good convening. And Rich, you might want to talk about a couple of the people we've observed who were good.
We've actually got some good local examples of this. There's, again, not many people here remember this, but we used to drive down the street, and you would see on the back of a truck, large trucks, 20 or 30 license plates. And it was a period of time when every state that a truck went into, they had to register individually there, pay taxes individually. And Roger, too, was a tax commissioner who worked here and spent literally his career convening a group that began to rationalize that process that created trust among states so that each state began to trust the audit capacity of the others. And they formed the International Fuel Tax Association, which really became an integrated place that still exists, therefore is a value alliance, because it has a really small office of seven people that now regulate that industry, and trucks can register in their home state, pay taxes, take care of all of the responsibilities they have in other states, but do it on a much simpler, more cost-efficient basis.
And you had one person who everyone respected, who was engaged, was passionate, everyone trusted.
Trusted and saw the opportunity there, began to pull people together, and they created literally a collaboration of the 48 continental states.
You know, I'm trying to think who would that person be. Again, I don't want to keep going, drawing back into politics, but I'm thinking, I think George Mitchell was one.
I think
do they still exist, these statespeople?
They exist, and they're not always the people who are best known.
Yeah.
Huh. You get into the halls of Congress, there are people who can convene in a very – and it's all based on trust. Now, I will tell you that I think ultimately the convener in our form of government ultimately has to be the president or the governor, and they've been given a special opportunity by the people to be the leader of an executive branch. A person who understood this well was Ted Kennedy. Kennedy, frankly, was a pretty good convener, and there's a long history of convening between he and Orrin Hatch. It doesn't have to be a single person. It can be literally two. Sometimes it can be more, but but Kennedy, who I worked with a lot and learned to really respect, we were working on a healthcare problem, and he said, "Mike, what needs to happen is the president needs to call a small group down to Blair House and needs to bring them in, sit them down, and say, look, let's work together and become the person who draws people together." Ultimately, that's at the heart of good convening. It's a sense of trust. It's a sense of power. Sometimes it's fear. Sometimes convener comes not because of fear, but because of people worry what they might do. It's a complex thing, but the convening power is a necessary part of collaboration.
Well, you do write about one of the factors in all of this is altruism, you say, is a good thing, but self-interest is an important thing you have to keep in mind. People come together because they have
Most often, what brings people together is a sense of, most real serious collaborations come through a Darwinian instinct to survive.
Right.
It's really essential, I think, if you're going to have an underpinning to this, you have to have something that you are motivated to get out of it.
Let's take some questions from the audience. Kurt is out there somewhere. Kurt, stand up.
Oh, I'm here. Hello, I'm Governor Leavitt Richard. My name is Kurt Manwaring, and I'm studying political science here at the U. It seems, especially in politics, there are people with ideologies which aren't only radically different, but also in some cases diametrically opposed to each other. You know, just look at Ted Cruz and Barack Obama, for example, in certain instances. And I'm wondering, how do you foster meaningful cooperation between people whose ideologies are in many ways opposite?
It's a great question and a good illustration, that in some respects, Cruz turned out to be a convener on one side, and the president is a convener on another. And we have a system of government, really, that is designed to have them collide. And it makes the point I suggested earlier that I think that our government was not designed in a collaborative model. It was designed, really, with checks and balances to produce the kind of tension and conflict that it does. However, there are moments in time when the problems just become so severe and the costs so high that kind of conflict either has to go away or you've got to figure a different way of solving the problem. And And I think we'll come to that point. So your point is a great one. And there are times when in a democratic process, they're designed not to agree or not to come together and to produce conflict. And that's happening. But my point is that there'll be a time when the problem gets severe enough that either the democracy will have to begin to yield faster, or we'll have to use extra processes to solve these dilemmas.
Now, I think you can anticipate some of those dilemmas, too. You take health care, which seems prominent on everybody's mind right now, but you've got Medicare and Medicaid that are both accelerating in terms of the consumption they have on the dollars that are being used. There's a collision out there that's going to occur when reimbursement rates, because of that, are going to be reduced, and it's going to change. It's going to create an upheaval in the medical industry and with providers and payers and the medical products industry. Everybody is going to be reactive to that, and it's anticipating how they might operate in a different world with lower reimbursement rates, and the structural changes will come as a consequence. And you begin to see networks form up, and we're beginning to see that happen now in the private sector to begin to deal with that issue.
You know, I'm reminded of a story that I think might be interesting. 1993, I had been elected only a year. In the 92 campaign, Bill Clinton got elected basically saying, I'm going to do something about health care. And I became persuaded that it'd be valuable to do something in Utah as opposed to just counting on the national government. And so as I began to draw people together, it became very clear to me that there was a lot of disagreement and that every year the same thing happened. We all talked a game and then nothing happened. And so I had a meeting in the state office building, and we had an entire auditorium full of interests. And I said, look, I want to find a solution to move health care forward in Utah. And I would like to create a process where we come up with three separate proposals. One would be a far left proposal, one would be a far right proposal, one would be kind of in the middle. And I'd like to have the legislature prepare that by the next time they will deal with one of those three proposals, or I'm prepared to take it to an initiative and get the people to decide which one they want. Well, it was a very dramatic thing to do, and I look back on it, and it was my first or second year. But I obviously had the ability as the convener to get people to take it seriously. Ultimately, the legislature acted unanimously to create a group called the Utah Health Commission and instructed them that over the next 8 years, they were to come up with a separate proposal for the legislature to act on, moving toward what we called the health print, which was a blueprint that we put forward. As you look back on it, it was remarkable. Utah Health Policy Commission acted 7 years in a row, and we acted a lot of health reforms that are at the bedrock of Utah today, and one of the reasons I think Utah has low health care costs by comparison and a very high percentage of people who have insurance by comparison to others. That happened because of convening that ultimately drove a collaborative process for seven straight years. Now, that would, I think, make the point, first of all, that states are better able to handle this kind of thing than the federal government, but it does bring you back to how convening collaborative processes and giving it structure does lead people to come to conclusions they wouldn't come to on their own.
Former Governor Mike Leavitt is with us along with Rich McKee, and they're co-authors of the book Finding Allies, Building Alliances, 8 Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. We're here in the caucus room, the Hinckley Institute of Politics, the campus of the University of Utah. We'll get to more of your questions when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with former Governor Mike Leavitt. We have also Rich McKeon with us, who served as Governor Leavitt's Chief of Staff at Health and Human Services, the EPA, also the Governor's Office. They've co-written a book called Finding Allies, Building Alliances, 8 Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. And let's take another question here from the audience. McKenna is with us here in the audience.
Hi, my name is McKenna Nielsen. I'm a student here at the U. And I'm just wondering what are the specific 8 elements and if our Congress are lacking any of those now.
You want to bring another one or two into the mix?
We've talked about common pain that brings people together, but the first part of the book then is about finding allies. That's convener of stature, representatives of substance, and a leader, a committed leader. Those are the component pieces that are necessary at the table. Then we talked about building the alliance, and that basically has to do with creating a framework for it, a written draft of a document that includes a very precise statement of its purpose, and it convenes itself. Then we are in really those two categories. I think finding allies and building alliances became a fortuitous title in the sense that it kind of breaks down how you build this out. The one thing that we haven't talked about there is a common information base, but it's fairly self-explanatory in the sense that everybody needs to be operating in common with an information base. And that, in fact, may be one of the breakdowns in Congress, is that we, in fact, don't have a common information base. We're dealing with very segregated information, and people are advocates, not problem solvers, and they're holding close to the vest that which they have that supports their own position.
What do you do about that? For a while, it was the Congressional Budget Office, right? Everyone thought, we can all agree on this, but now no one seems to agree on that. And why is that? Is it because of the dynamic of the media, the dynamic of how these stories are played?
Well, I would point out that the Congress as an institution, again, was designed to have checks and balances. It was not designed as a collaborative institution. However, to make it work, collaboration has to happen inside the institutions because it has to be based on coalitions. You have to find people from all parts of the ideologic spectrum who can come together and collaboratively come up with a proposal that'll get a majority of the votes. So again, the difference is the structure is designed to create checks and balances, but to make it work, you've got to form collaborations within. CBO is an interesting example of the fact that you've got to have a common place, a trusted place to get information. Because people will always argue about the science or what math should be used or whose number. And I think in a wise way, they established institutionally, this is the way we're going to establish this fact, and we're going to have it free of politics. In state government, we have to do revenue estimates. Now, if you want to see an area that could be subject to a lot of judgments, it's revenue estimates. And if you get to the end of the day and you're trying to guess how much money is going to come in on tax, it is a scientific guess. But we have to base the budget on something. And so in order to create this collaborative effort, we set up a process that everyone agrees to. And so that's the point, is that if you're going to be successful, you've got to agree in advance on what the source of facts will be.
And not move the goalposts.
And not move the goalpost.
One that comes up... we've mentioned some of these dynamics. One of the 8 is what you call the northbound train. The least tangible, you say, Governor, of all the elements, but you say it's the most critical. And I guess the title of this term and this section in the book is based on a conversation you had. This is in 2012, I think it was, with former Governor Mitt Romney.
Well, it was the phrase is one I've used for a long time. I use in the book. I was planning the transition for what we hoped would be a Romney administration in Washington, and there were moments in time when it looked like it was a long shot. And then the first debate happened, and suddenly overnight, Mitt Romney looks like he's on a northbound train to become president. And the instant level of change about how intensely people and how willing people were was happened overnight. And the application here is that collaborations are almost always voluntary. People are at the table voluntarily because they believe they can do something that will further the common good and improve their situation. And what gives them power is that they can leave at any time. And so it requires the leader or the convener to be eminently fair. And if at any point in time the wrong people leave, you know it's going to fall apart and your opportunity to succeed is gone. So this sense that something's going to happen here, and if I'm not on the train, I'm going to miss my opportunity, is the yeast that makes the dough rise.
It's momentum?
It's momentum. It's a sense of anticipation. It's optimism. It's worth being here, because if I leave and I miss the chance, I'm going to miss out my chance to shape it. So we called it the northbound train, to say the train is moving north. There's a seat in it, and I want to be sitting in that seat. Otherwise, there's no collaboration.
And it's really a barometer to the outside world as well, because those whose interests are at stake but aren't represented want to join. And that's really the ideal world, and the ideal framework would be to create a situation where like-minded people would want to be there because they know decisions are being made that will affect them, and they'd like to be on the train as it begins to process itself towards resolution.
Here's an email came to us from Audrey, who writes, this is an interesting question. She said, in my experience in local politics, collaboration seems to come much more naturally to women. I don't see one of these have a woman involved, but what do you want to respond to that at all? Have you found
any
particulars?
Well, I don't know. I can't say that isn't true, I suppose. I do think that some people have a more natural tendency to be collaborative than others. Rich mentioned that people who just have an advocacy point of view, they are not as inclined to sit down and say, let's solve this problem. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'd like to hear
you evaluate the male-female part of this.
Yeah, well, thank you for throwing that one to me. I'm going to throw back other issues to you. But the notion here really is that there are people, and you know them, who are more open to this kind of discussion and problem solving. They have a tendency to gather together, frankly. They are mediators. They are collaborators. They are people whose minds are set toward problem solving. And we've got a whole profession lined up on advocacy, basically. And lawyers basically take positions, stake them out, and defend them. But the people who really, literally, have the ability to be transparent, who have an abundance mentality, who are principle focused, and by that I mean you've seen arguments where people take a position and they simply stick with that position. It's when you're in Guatemala and you're negotiating for a coat with somebody you don't understand the language and you're doing it on a calculator. That's very position-based discussion. But when you are principle-based, you are attempting to find a solution that's fair and equitable to everybody and that will lift everybody. And and you know who those people are. And I proposed this earlier, and frankly, there are people who don't believe that people like that can be made. They believe that they are born, and that's an evolution. I don't know that that's gender related. I think we've certainly seen those traits of collaborative capacity and collaborative IQ, is how we characterize it, in just every conceivable place that you could be.
I would like to add this. I believe that there are people who are more advocates and those that are more naturally collaborative, but it's important to have structure, because structure ultimately allows those who are less collaborative by nature to perform in a more collaborative way. It brings a sense of rule and order. I mean, if you looked at the Constitutional Convention, there were a lot of advocates there, and they were strong, and they had deeply seated ideologies. But it was the structure that they put around themselves, well studied, well written, well established, and then the existence of a convener and a common pain. All of those people, all of those came together to allow that to for those strong-minded advocates to ultimately come to a collaborative conclusion.
And this is articulation, I think, of that set of principles that guide you, that are recorded in the, as you put this down in your constitution, or basically in your draft. Those are the things that guide you, but you have to recognize that there are some who come to disrupt. I mean, there's some onboard terrorists or saboteurs who come to disrupt, who simply come to protect their own position and to undermine what you're doing. And they literally, as you indicated earlier, Doug, sometimes need to be extricated.
So you've got, let's use this idea of a constitution as an illustrator of this idea. One of the crucial elements, have a formal charter. you say this is a crucial part of the process because, Governor, you've talked about when you this is when you really know. I guess this is when the rubber really meets the road. This is when you know if you have a common interest here, once you've laid that out. We've got about a minute left. Say something about that part.
Well, I would just say that most collaboration, most alliances, rather, are essentially limited purpose private governments where people organize a means by which they will interact. And learning how to do that can speed up complex problem solving. And at the root of it, this book is about getting complicated things done.
Look, we have just another moment here. So I did want to say, do you feel hopeful? I mean, I'm thinking about the Affordable Care Act now because healthcare is one of these big complicated issues, how this is all going to play out in the wake of what's going on right now related to the Affordable Care Act. You've got all this gridlock. You've got a very messy rollout of this program. It's become emotional. It's become nasty.
There's nowhere in the American economy that this is playing out with more splendor than in healthcare. Healthcare right now in every healthcare market in America is being reshaped and requiring and the organizations that will win, that will succeed, that will survive, are those that can weave themselves into a productive collaborative network to produce better care at a lower cost. In the past, we've been exactly the opposite of that. Everyone operating as a general contractor and no one acting as a subcontractor. And now we're seeing over and over this collaborative problem solving becoming a premium.
That's Mike Leavitt, former governor of Utah, former secretary of Health and Human Services in the George W. Bush administration. Rich McKeon served as Leavitt's chief of staff. Together, they co-founded the healthcare consulting firm Leavitt Partners, co-authors of the book Finding Allies, Building Alliances, 8 Elements That Bring and Keep People Together. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to the Hinckley Institute, to Kirk Jowers, Jane Nelson, and Elsie Bali. Thanks also to Radio West's Taylor Almond and Mike Anderson. The show directed today by our engineer, Lewis Downey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.